I don't know why I'm being so critical. I'm not the greatest. I have a bit of a tremor. That's distracting in a performer.
Why don't you take a medication to offset the hundreds of medications you're already on so that I feel more comfortable?
To which I'd like to say, weakness is the brand.
And that brand is strong. Holy moly, Maria Bamford is here. It's The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. When people ask me who my favorite stand-up comedian is, the first name that always comes to mind is Maria Bamford. I've probably seen her perform live more than any other comedian, partly because she goes up in so many big and small venues all over LA, but also because I always want to see what she's working on. 30 years into a career that started when she was a teenager doing open mics in Minnesota, she's always funny, utterly fearless, and completely unpredictable. Maria's unique abilities are on full display in her latest hour-long special, Weakness is the Brand, which premieres this week across several streaming platforms. She's also currently hosting a web series called What's Your Ailment for Topic.com, in which she talks to other celebrities about their shared mental health issues. I'll be honest, Maria is kind of an acquired taste. She's either your absolute favorite or you find her kind of baffling. The same will probably be true for this episode. If you love this podcast as much as I love Maria Bamford, please help us out by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Feel free to let me know which episodes have been your favorite so far and who else you want to hear on the show. You can also go to ratethispodcast.com/laugh to rate this podcast wherever you listen. Buckle up. This is me with Maria Bamford. So, and I just got to see your new special, Weakness is the Brand, the screener of it. And when this episode comes out, it will be out so people can get it. And that's so exciting. But it was really fun for me to watch the special because I've actually gotten to see you perform parts of this material several times over the last year, I think. I feel like, well, first of all, I'm such a big fan of yours, and I've seen you probably more than most comedians in my life. But I saw you at Clusterfest, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
I saw you at Dynasty Typewriter, those shows earlier last year. And then at the at Largo for Gary Gulman's event with Judd Apatow, which was fantastic.
Oh, and that nice, yeah.
That was just a really nice event. Yes. You and Patton Oswalt and yeah. Gary Gulman and Judd Apatow. And so it was fun to kind of see it all come together in the special. And it's a really phenomenal, phenomenal hour. So can you, I guess just to start, can you talk kind of about that process of working out material in all these different places and then kind of molding it into one big thing for the special?
Oh yeah. What I do, or and I don't know what other comics do, but I just start at zero all mm-hmm. over again, and then the past few years I've been I'll get some time at there's a Black Box Theater in Hollywood at Vermont and Hollywood Boulevard, mm-hmm. Best parking in Los Angeles, right between John's Supermarket and mm-hmm. Fayez Paredes. And I'll do an hour there and just work on it, you know, the newer material over and 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 over again. And then, you know, hopefully it becomes something, or at least I fill an hour.
Yeah. You've talked about this before, but you like to run your material one-on-one with people sometimes before shows. So everyone listening might not know about that. Can you kind of explain what that process is like?
If you've heard of Twitter, it's such a loving, sweet, gentle place. You put on your Twitter feed, hey, at this time in this zip code, could anyone meet me for coffee? I'll buy. That's important mm-hmm. to say that.
Yeah.
Everything's on me. Sky's the limit. And then people tweet back and go, I'm available in that odd part of St. Louis, Missouri at 3 p.m. And then you connect with them via the Twitter mail. And then you get to meet a nice person in the middle of nowhere. And not nowhere. St. Louis is an important city. Mm-hmm. So it's just delightful. I've done it about, I want to say, at least 30 times.
Wow.
And everyone's been very, very pleasant. I did a lot of internet dating. Mm-hmm. back in the day.
Yeah.
And I think I went on probably like 75 internet dates over the course of 10 years. So it didn't seem that scary to me at all.
Similar to that.
Yeah, it's just, for the most part, you're going to meet very pleasant people who are just trying to have a nice time. And of course, no creepy romantic intentions with these people, which really takes the edge off.
Have there been any sort of odd situations that have arisen from it, or is it pretty...
the only thing, I think I had one where I yelped where a coffee was, mm-hmm. and so I had this poor guy meet me. I thought it was a coffee shop. It was an industrial coffee packaging company in the middle of an office park, and then... because I had taken a lift mm-hmm. there from the Hampton Inn, he had to drive me to a nearby Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah, went to a Dunkin' Donuts, and then they were cleaning so much mm-hmm. in the Dunkin' Donuts that we had to sit in the 100 degree parking lot. But it's that kind of added value,
mm-hmm.
authenticity. Isn't that what everyone's looking for? Something real.
Yeah. Well, why did you decide that this was something that you wanted to do, and what do you kind of get out of it?
Oh my God, it is all for me. Mm-hmm. It is a very selfish drive in that I have a difficult time getting myself to rehearse mm-hmm. my material, and something I didn't used to when I was younger, because I had the drive within. I think it's called ambition, if I can remember that word correctly. And so now I have to get a witness.
Mm-hmm.
The witness is very powerful, because to sit and watch me go through the whole thing, and so I am definitely the winner in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
I hope people are having a good time. I've offered, now realizing how much I'm getting out of it, to help out with anything. If somebody can bring mm-hmm. something that's doable within a couple of hours.
Like, what's an example of that?
I can clean your glasses. I can make a call to AT&T.
That's a good one.
Yeah, sit on the phone for at least the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
With Sean in Punjabi. And then I did help a woman fill out Christmas cards.
Mm-hmm.
So I am now, comedy is no longer enough, I think.
Yeah,
I think
you have to give back even more.
Oh, come on. I mean, I'd like to think that the arts are really affecting grassroots change change at a grassroots level. But mm-hmm. I'm a little worried. So let me help you go through your receipts.
And people have taken you up on this.
Yes,
stuff.
Yes, yes. And it helps. Again, I feel less useless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, I think one of the big themes of the special, in some ways, is this idea of giving back, or sort of wanting to do something and not always knowing what to do. And and it comes into the stuff with your mom and religion, and how, she's a Christian and you're not, and who's sort of the better person, and kind of all that kind of stuff. So, but it does seem like something that you struggle with, or at least think about a lot, is how to be a good person.
Do you ever feel like you just want to know that you're a pretty good person? Like that you're good as... someone everyone considers to be pretty good. Maybe you're not Santa, but you're not the Golden State serial killer. Like you're, or maybe you're just better than one person. And I always think it's gotta be somebody who's following a religion, who's deeply religious. So then you can go mano a mano and examples from their own philosophy, so you could see who's ahead, like who specifically is winning. So I called my mom. I said, Mom, you're a Christian. Would you be willing to go with me 3 rounds in your own religion to see which one of us is the better person? And she said, what? I mean, I do have a strain of OCD where that is my that can be kind of my obsession, is like getting into the weeds about what the right thing is to do. So most of it, I think, is something that just kind of passes the time in my brain, mm-hmm. of like, you know, it's like, Maria, well, the thing to do really would be to volunteer as much as you can. And, you know, not only that, but, you know, give more of your income to charities. And we do give 11% of of our income to charities, or at least the nonprofits and stuff like that. And then so we can be 1% over the Christians. But then my bookkeeper turns out as a Christian. Okay. And I was like, and I said, this is what I'm trying to do. And she said, well, Christians actually give 10% of the gross.
Oh.
And I was like, nah. Anyways, I looked it up. Dave Ramsey, who's that guy? He's a Christian guy.
Yeah.
No, he's not.
Anyways, no one's doing that, yeah.
Mindy, I don't know if she's correct. But I know there is a Christian bank, and that is hilarious.
Yeah. What did you find out about the Christian bank?
Oh, it's online. If you want to have your values-centered credit card, what? If I'm going to be spending 22% in interest, I want to make sure it's going to the right executives. Oh, that's so strange.
So you, in that bit about your mom, the kind of, I don't want to spoil the punchline, but you do talk about how you've been imitating her on stage for quite a long
35
time.
35 years,
now.
Yeah.
And how that factors into the whole thing. What how has that kind of evolved over that time from her perspective of you portraying her on stage? Was she always okay with it or not okay with it? Or how?
She's been okay with it. I mean, she is like a very, has less things roll off. I think that is a trait of mothers in general, mm-hmm. where you've heard years of your kids going, that's stupid, mom. So finally you're just like, at least that's what I think is going mm-hmm. on. Cause she's just like, oh, that's great, honey.
Yeah.
And
she must be very used to it now, I guess.
Yeah. I've got my own life.
Yeah.
And, so she, But other, you know, I used to do an impersonation of my sister, but she really felt hurt by that, you know, and said, you know, I don't want you to do that anymore. So I'm trying desperately not to do when it's hard because she's very funny.
Yeah.
And
you ever accidentally slip into it on stage?
yes, I have. And then hopefully none of that's recorded. And and that is weird. After doing it for a long time, I think I get like, oh, what? I'm working on a new hour now, mm-hmm. And what to talk about next? Do you find that with your job? Like, what?
Yeah, there's always a what's next. How to gotta come up with the new ideas.
Yeah, the new idea, and then go, am I just doing this because it's new, or mm-hmm. is this really necessary?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I tried to tell myself the only reason it's necessary is because I'm alive, and mm-hmm. because you know, you're a little flower and the sun's out and you just got to bloom,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless of course it's not time yet. But I think that's sometimes I feel a little bit, I think I get into the ethical anxiety about taking space up in the world, mm-hmm. that I'm almost 50 years old. I'm a very well off, as far as I can tell from the internet calculators of what rich is, doing well, white lady, am I really necessary? You know, mm-hmm. in terms of being a performer and stuff, like there's just so many more, they just voices that haven't been heard, and they're so interesting. And so that has definitely become an issue of like, oh, I don't even know if I want to hear what I have to say anymore, despite the fact that I keep talking.
What drives you to keep doing it then?
Part of it is just that there is fun in it, to think of a new joke, and also a source of income and belonging as a part of a community that I belong with other comedians. I get to do a last night. I did a new joke, and it felt so good because it went real nice.
Yeah,
went real nice, and it felt like a nice warm glow. and
can you share the joke?
Yes, of course. that it's about how I love children's books, and I think it's because, okay, there's a cat, and the cat's a baker. You can tell he's a baker because he wears the little poofy hat, and then he has a apron on, and he's carrying a steaming bun. But he's also a cat. Anyways, or you know, and then there's all different kind of animals, but there's an alligator driving super fast. He's funny, and he's laughing, he has a hat on. What I love about these scenes, you never question, there's no backstory. You know, there's no like, oh, the cat actually inherited the business, and the quality of the product has really gone down. And I mean, it's really a testament to, if you have passion in something, it really goes, because the recipes are the same, but that bun is not good. It's not. It's not very good. The alligator, the reason he's driving so fast throughout the book, and you see it, he's laughing, but that's because he's got to be in a good mood to get 5 stars on Uber and Lyft. And he's got mints, he's got water, and he's being chased by the cop, who's a mouse. And the cop is one of the good ones, though. He has a bullet wound to the head where... the bullet's still in there. And at that point, he had been 19, how long do mice live? 19 months in the police force. And he thought, do I still want to keep doing this? But he's like, no. And so when he's chasing the alligator, it's not because there's an alligator quota of people to arrest. It's that he genuinely wants the alligator to slow down because it's not safe. And I guess I love those because they just label, you know, they go, you know, taxi driver, you know, cook, and like
it just happens to be an alligator. Coming up, Maria looks back at the early part of her comedy career, including a legendary tour with Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, and Zach Galifianakis that was brilliantly captured in the documentary The Comedians of Comedy.
Like, let's say I was a bear and I was a comedian. You know, oh, it's the bear who's a comedian. You never question, oh, is she any good? No. It says comedian. I'm a bear. Of course I'm hilarious. I make the whole town laugh.
That's great. That was like my experience of you in a coffee shop with a fan.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it.
That's kind of how it goes.
That's exactly how it goes. And, I try to make more eye contact, but not too much, depending on what people want.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do the half mast. Yeah. I keep my eyes half open, and then I can do Madonna and Child. You know, just, if people make requests for different kinds of eye contact, I can do it.
Yeah. I'd love to kind of talk about, you know, how this all started for you, going, because I know you started doing comedy incredibly young, right? In Minnesota?
Yeah, 19.
That's pretty young.
Pretty young.
Yeah. So when you were starting, I mean, how did you kind of decide that was going to be what you wanted to do? And when you started, did you think this was going to be your whole life and career?
No, it just seemed like a great idea for whatever reason. And I just went by myself, and it seemed like in high school, you know, when you did speeches and stuff like that, I just thought, oh, it seems like that. And then you just do whatever you want. And they have sort of, which they still have, but artsy scene. So I did, you know, women's with two Y's and an M and a capital I and a Z nights, and then did performance art venues and that type of thing. And I did a one-person show because that meant more time. And I didn't do comedy clubs as much. There was a club in town, but I just didn't feel like that was totally for me. But it wasn't. I think I read The Artist Way about 3 years into doing whatever I was doing. I was calling it stand up. And then I was like, oh, that's what I would like to call myself as a comedian. So I think that helped me realize that, oh, this is the job that I would like. But I think, at least for me, there's always I always want to be open-minded to doubt. The way sometimes I read society is like, oh, you've got to stay with one thing and also, one other thing is you've got to be so good at it.
Always getting better.
Always getting better. Yeah. And it's like, well, that isn't tenable.
Yeah.
As we go towards death.
Yeah.
If I'm going to still participate, I got to be okay with losing my edge. If I ever had one.
I think so.
Yeah.
Think so. Was there a moment when you moved to, did you move out to LA first from Minnesota?
Moved to LA. I was there in Minneapolis for 3 years, and then I moved to LA in 1994, right after the earthquake, and then really had a hard time the first 2 years. Kind of fell into a hole of not. I just didn't know how to have a job keep a job. Mm-hmm.
You kind of had day jobs and then doing comedy at night? Or?
Yeah, I just would. I did food service jobs, which is awesome if you're good at it. But Los Angeles is a place where there's a high standard of service as well.
Yeah, and a lot of actors trying to be waiters during the day.
Yeah, and some people really have a gift at doing it. And so for any number of reasons. So finally, I got some outside help of people saying, you know, I went to a support group and for money-related stuff. And it could be Debtors Anonymous. I can't say if it is because it's supposed to be a secret fight club. but I went someplace and they, just got a lot of community support of like, what else can you do? Is there anything else you can do?
Yeah.
Okay, oh my God, you can type. Okay, why don't you temp? So then I started temping, and that was a lifesaver. I worked for 10 years doing office work during the day while doing stand-up and whatever else at night. And that was just worked out very, very well in terms of not only, just stability. Mm-hmm. Just having food and shelter isn't overrated. It is the most important thing. So I
think that the first time that I kind of became aware of you as a comedian was in the Comedians of Comedy documentary, which came out 15 years ago, 2005. And I hadn't seen it since it came out, so I just rewatched it.
Oh, hilarious.
It's so good. And I know it was produced by Netflix, but I don't think it's on Netflix anymore. So I kind of found a bootleg version on YouTube.
Hilarious.
So people should seek that out if they haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's you and Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn and Zach Galifianakis going on tour kind of up and down the West Coast.
Yes, yes.
And it's a really great. It really captures a moment in comedy, I think. And you guys were kind of doing something different where you weren't doing comedy clubs. You were booking rock, kind of indie rock venues and performing for maybe an audience that wouldn't go to a comedy club and doing really kind of more alternative stuff. And it's the beginning of that or part of that alternative scene. So when you think about sort of that time in your life, what kind of comes to mind and what was that experience like of being with those guys on the road and all that stuff?
Well, it was only a week worth of time, and I was just grateful to have a job, and it was all I believe bankrolled by Netflix as well as Patton. Patton was the real figurehead and producer behind it.
And this is back when Netflix was still sending DVDs in the mail.
Yes, in the mail, and he So I am forever grateful to Patton that he wanted, because that was, it was so, it was really fun. And then also it was, yeah, it was, I think, something that helped me in my career, because I wasn't well known at all. And I mean, not that it's variable on how I, but yeah, so it was great. And yeah, because I had at the time, I think, yeah, I did. I had a few things, times when I've gone to comedy clubs and I had gotten sent home, because I just, there's a certain, before the internet, mm-hmm. You wouldn't know what you're coming to see. Mm-hmm. And that is where heckling and real stinging disappointments can happen.
Sent home in the sense that you got on and
yeah,
got,
they're like, no. Yeah, you're not, or either I'm not ready or I'm not, mm-hmm. I'm not.
You weren't the right fit.
Not the right fit. Yeah. And I was just, I was relieved, frankly. So the rock venues, and then being with Patton before I'd go up, he would make a, you know, very lovely opening of like, this woman is like, you know, saying, she's my friend. And like, it was very, yeah,
he's setting you up for success.
Setting you up for success, which is so important and a very kind thing to do, because he didn't have to do that. You know, mm-hmm. It was very kind. I have this therapist. I prefer to call her therapist, and because I don't take it seriously, and she told me this part. I have a lot of anxiety, right? And so she told me it's important to like just, I should try to sing my anxieties aloud, because that kind of takes the power away from them. Takes the power away. And so I've come up with a new tune, and it's set to the theme from The Bodyguard, starring Whitney Houston. Okay. If I keep my ice cube trays clean, then God can't kill me. And if I clench my fists at odd intervals, then the darkness within me can't take over my hands and force me to do something I don't want to do that's inappropriately sexual or violent.
You guys were all pretty early in your career. You know, I think in the movie, Zach Galifianakis is talking about how he's maybe been in like one movie and it wasn't very good, and you know, now he's like this huge massive movie star. And I think Brian Posehn is the one who's getting flocked by fans on the road, which is also kind of funny. He was on Just Shoot Me.
Yep. He was so tall. So
nobody
it's like
knows
people
who Zach
can.
Is, yeah. But they're.
I know it is. Oh gosh, it is so interesting how things change and how things stay the same, because I think those kind of shows now are still a total regular thing. Mm-hmm. I know so many comics, and the festival circuit is huge now, and it's just
you never have to perform in a comedy club if you don't want to.
Well, the thing is, I love comedy clubs. Mm-hmm. love them. I wish they would become more accessible to everybody, because mm-hmm. they are still, I think they're leaving money on the table. Like, I just think that's why these festivals are doing well, or is because they're inclusive of, because it's bizarre how mm-hmm. you'll go to a comedy club. I think I went to one. I won't name names, but mm-hmm. you go to many, and maybe there'll be a picture of a famous comedian on the wall who's never been there, like Margaret Cho or like Lucille Ball or something. But that's it. Maybe another, I'll be the one, there'll be maybe two or three comics a year who are headlining who are women or, and then people, women of color. Like in the 0.5%, it is bizarre.
Yeah. And you're saying they're leaving money on the table. It's like they could be getting more people to come into their club, but they're sort of using this old model or old way of thinking.
I don't understand it. And I don't have a club, so I don't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So it would be very interesting. Like I know when I didn't do well on weekends because, you know, when you do a weekend thing as a comic, it's more likely that a bunch of people will come who go, it's somebody who kind of looks like me on the screen. Maybe I'll go in. I'll stop in. I was going to return something at Bed Bath & Beyond, but I think I'm just going to wander in this club. And that makes it much more of a craftsmanship job of, mm-hmm. like, you've got to be likable and amenable to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that is not something I'm not gifted at. I'm not good at it. So I would do weekday shows, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and just do a door deal so that I could just hopefully break even. But if I could get a crowd on those days that normally the club doesn't have a huge crowd, then that's wonderful. And I wonder why they don't do that. But I don't know. I don't know what it's like to, because owning a club, I'm sure, is a huge thing and lots of money involved. So I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm very curious. I love to have curiosity about things I know nothing about, which I guess is what curiosity is all about. It's odd. But I just have, and I also have heard so many stories by just hearsay through other female comics where it's like, you know, how difficult it is to get an opener or middle act. And that the income hasn't gone up for openers and middles since 25 years ago.
That's not great.
Wow.
Yeah. But as you said, on the bright side, there are these other opportunities, the festivals, and the smaller rooms and different kinds of venues.
Which is great, and you create your own opportunities. And at the same time, I just want to acknowledge that there's still a level that the door isn't open, mm-hmm. you know, which it seems that, yeah, is prejudice or, statistically unjust. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. So going back to your new special, you know, you've always been very open about your, you know, issues around mental health. And you talk about it in your new special that you actually have been doing, you know, and feeling a lot better in the last few years.
Yes.
You know, and you're married now and you have this stable relationship. And so how has that affected your output or how do you kind of think about that in terms of how that's changed, you know, what you're able to do?
Well, it's been awesome because he is also he's a painter, he's an artist, mm-hmm. and then also he's super funny. So he's really inspired me in many, many different ways. And it's just been, I think also that thing of where does the ambition go? It's like, oh, I could just go home and have a nice snuggle with my husband and my two dogs. Well, what am I doing in here in Koreatown trying to find a parking space at 10 p.m.? It also, I think, brings down sort of that pressure of having to get better or somehow fill this endless hole of Terminator-like productivity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like... It might not matter in the end. So that's nice to know.
Speaking of the mental health stuff, I did want to touch on you're doing a sort of internet talk show. Your ailment?
Yes, what's your ailment?
For Topic, I believe. Yeah.
Yes.
So how did that come about, and why was that something that you wanted to do?
I thought it would be fun to interview other people who are open to talking about their experience, and the topic. It came up with the idea for the show, mm-hmm. and it just sounded like it was something I could do and be fun, and I've never interviewed people before.
Yeah.
It turns out, if you watch the show, you'll see how I have difficult time making eye contact with people, and I kind of squinch up my face and kind of stare off. Anyways, it's hilarious in that way. And so that, yeah, it was really nice to hear the stories of other people, and I hope it's helpful to I like to joke that it's the least helpful form of health care you could get if you only have $2.99. Why not watch a talk show?
Yeah.
Is it better than the free clinic? I don't know.
Yeah. It's different.
It's different.
Maybe more entertaining than the free clinic.
Maybe more entertaining than the free clinic. Or something to watch while you're waiting at the free clinic. There you go.
Combo.
Combo platter. Yeah, because I think that is one of my arguments I like to tell myself, is that it's better to get any help than even if it's super shitty. Like,
yeah.
It's better just go. Just go get whatever they have on offer that's in your zip code. Mm-hmm. And even if it's really terrible, that's going to be some great stories eventually. But, yeah, I'm trying to think. Because I have this intrusive thoughts OCD thing, so I had a therapist say that she might have to call the police, after I told her what my intrusive thoughts were, and I was like, okay.
It's not what you want to hear.
It wasn't exactly what I wanted to hear, but maybe sometimes people do have to call the police, and that's fine too, but hilarious in retrospect, and then I'm like, no, if you knew about what this OCD is, I'm actually the least likely person to do. I sit on my hands all day because I don't want to do anything. Uh-huh. So do anything awful. But what else have I had? I had the, which is in the special, how I got on betterhelp.com because I thought, I'm on the road, so I thought maybe that would be easier to have someone who I could text all the time.
Yeah.
And then one of the second times she texted me, the therapist said, Christine, of course you're stressed. You just had a baby. And I'm like, oh, my God. The one thing that's good about therapy is that they are focused on you for 2 seconds. And it's like, no, she's toggling seven phones.
Yeah.
Like, she's...
didn't make you... didn't give you a lot of confidence.
But it was still kind of helpful.
Yeah.
It was like, oh... Yeah, you're right. Christine is stressed. Of course she's stressed. She just had a fucking baby. Well, I kind of just had a baby too.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of like Christine. Kind of.
A lot of these themes also obviously showed up in your Netflix show, Lady Dynamite, which I quite loved. It was ran for 2 seasons. And, you know, was sadly didn't go beyond that. But I wonder how you felt about it, because I know you talked about how difficult it was in a lot of ways and overwhelming in some ways. So how did you find out that it wasn't going to continue? And then how did you feel about it?
Oh, well, I think I want to say that Pam Brady and Mitch Hurwitz called me and they said, Marie, do you have a second? Yeah, I mean, I think you can feel sad. I felt sad that it was over on some level. It just in the fact of like wanting to be needed, you know, wanting, oh God, we gotta have that show back.
Yeah.
You know, like
even if you didn't,
it was like, oh, to want to be wanted.
Yeah,
definitely. But it was. I am on some certain psychiatric meds that make me really tired.
Mm-hmm.
So 12 to 16 to 18 hour days aren't doing the show was at the far edge of my abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Like So, which is so hilarious because it's like your dream comes true and then suddenly I'm too tired to do it. Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, I think you did achieve something really special with the show in the 2 seasons. And it's so innovative and different and hilarious and capture something, I think, you know, as someone on the outside, you know, it seems to capture the rhythms of it, really capture something about the, you know, your life and what you've gone through and all that. So I think it's an incredible achievement in that sense.
Thanks. Yeah, no.
And you must have had some pretty fervent fans.
Yes. Yeah. It's been wonderful. Yeah. No. It was really a wonderful experience. Just so many lovely people. It was an unbelievable dream come true. And everything's happened for me that I've ever wanted and beyond. And I'm good. I'm good.
Up next, Maria shares her personal regrets about continuing to work with Louis C.K. after hearing the rumors about his behavior. You don't want to miss it. So what I want to do now is run through a few other of your credits from your career that we didn't get to talk about yet and see if there's a sort of memory or story that jumps out to you.
Okay, hopefully. Yeah.
So the first one is your late night stand-up debut, which I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, was on Conan in 1999.
Yes, yes.
What do you remember about that?
Well, the one thing I remember, and this may be for, I just always want to tell people who, you know, it was a dream come true to, of course, be on the television. I don't know why I should say, of course, people don't have that dream. But I felt so terrified and scared for the 2 weeks coming up. I felt like sick and not like it was going to be okay. Not like, oh, I'm just nervous. Like, I felt like it might not go well like that. I felt that the whole time. I felt so scared and up and while they're, you know, they put you in hair and makeup, and I was shaking so badly that the woman's like, "Are you going to be okay?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And
could go either way.
Could go either way. And the one thing I told myself is, like, even if I bomb, like, or it's like ridiculous how terribly I do, you know, like, I'm barely able to say a word and then I just run off.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that'll inspire someone. Like, oh, Jesus, she can do that. Like, I don't know. I tried to create some sort of false engine of meaning within myself like, I'm doing something meaningful.
Yeah. Even if the worst possible thing happens.
I'm being useful. And that's
that
what I need.
That got you through it?
It got me through it.
Yeah.
And then it turned out beautifully. And but I was so surprised that something that I had dreamed of would feel so terrifying and unbearable at the time. Like,
yeah.
I just was like, I just found that so surprising.
Yeah.
Hey, my name is Maria, and I'm originally from Duluth, Minnesota. Duluth in the house, oh yeah! My mother told me before I went to my first girl-boy party in the eighth grade, she said, "Maria, remember what we talked about? Gonorrhea, syphilis, herpes, 1, 2, watch the cold sores. Date rape is a lot more common than people think. You look so gorgeous. You were conceived in Groton, Connecticut in one night in a campsite. I am not saying you weren't planned. I'm just saying Bamfords get pregnant like falling off logs. Oh, Jenny's mom's here to pick you up. Will he have a good time?"
Has it gotten any easier to perform stand-up on TV?
Yes, yes. Yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, but it is... That was so. It made me realize just you know, my expectations are very that I never thought that the dream job would be kind of like a regular job, where, because I would have secretarial jobs and I'd be scared to show up, because I'd be scared, like, oh, I don't know how the phone works, and I'm in this big conference room, and what if, you know, somebody yells at me. And I felt that nerves for office jobs, and then to have it in this thing where it's like I'm lucky to have it. And that's also a weird thing where it's like you're having this peak experience that you're lucky to have, and then how do you share that with other people? Like, I don't feel good. And they're like, you lucky asshole, shut up.
I'm grateful,
So, anyways, if you're ever in that position, if you're about to receive, get your first whatever Academy Award and you feel terrible, just know you're not alone.
One thing that I had no idea you had done until I saw it on your IMDb page was writing for the Martin Short show.
Yes.
How did that come about and what was that like?
Well, I think it was one of those show business things where somebody said I was, you know, a new thing and they were trying to get a writing room together. And so I wrote, you know, they had me in. And it was a group. I was the only woman, and I'm not very good in groups. So I think I was also a lot younger and was not good at holding my own or speaking up. Oh, my goodness. And Martin Short's brother was the head writer, and I would hand him my scripts, and they would come back with red all over them, like, not funny, big question mark, don't get it. Oh. And so I think, I want to say about 5 weeks in, I got fired. I'm sure I was awkward and a weirdo and, you know, desperately trying to fit in. And somebody told me later that they were, that one of the other writers said, oh, it's, I didn't want to tell you this while you were working there, but one of the people there would do impersonations of you whenever you would leave the room.
Oh, my God.
Like, oh no. But...
Did you have much interaction with Martin Short?
No, and he not too much, and he seemed a rainbow of energy, just a lovely person and extremely professional and energetic. And everybody was doing the best they could. And I think I did get one joke in, and that was a wonderful feeling to get. Like, I think he was doing an award show, and I wrote one of the jokes, and and I was like, oh my God, I can't find it. So that was...
But it didn't make you want to be in writer's rooms for the rest of your career.
I think I'm not... I don't want to fight for my own vision. Yeah. I just go, you know, because I even on my own show, I spent a few days in the writer's room, and where it's like, you have to work it out with everybody. And I just thought, you know... I get too upset and emotional on things that now I can't even remember. So it's like, just let it go. Just enjoy memorizing the lines and
let them do the work, and I'll say the words.
The excruciatingly, really hard. It's like math putting scripts together, and so was so happy that there was a lovely group of coconuts who would do it.
One performance of yours that I really enjoyed was on Louis, Louis C.K.'s show. I thought that was just a really great performance, acting performance that you gave.
Oh, thanks.
Hello?
Hi. So listen, either you gave me the crabs or I gave you the crabs, but anyway, I have the crabs, and you were inside me last week, so you got crabs too.
Jesus.
You didn't feel itchy?
Yeah, but I thought it was laundry detergent.
No. Crabs. So you or sorry. I don't know which one.
Obviously it has some complications, you know, now in with Louis C.K.
Certainly does.
So I'm just wondering how you think about that, or do you think about it any differently now compared to, you know, when you were doing it?
Well, I want to say a couple months before all the news came out with you know, real factual evidence, you know, people coming forward, I had worked with him. I opened for him when he was at it's the Chinese, whatever the theater is at, on Hollywood Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. Yeah. I love to make money. So, yeah. and he is, you know, was a great, you know, performer, comedian. And I had heard of those allegations, but I couldn't find any, like, anyone who said, oh, this is what happened. This,
yeah.
So I thought there were rumors. Now, of course, I go, even if there's rumors, just don't do it.
Yeah.
Just don't. Or inquire,
yeah.
Like get in there, which I feel ashamed that I didn't get into it out of, I think, greed.
Mm-hmm.
And so
maybe even partly not wanting to believe it because he was someone that you had worked with and knew, right?
Yeah. You think, oh, you hope for that, but yeah, it is always, and I guess I don't, yeah, it's just so sad. Mm-hmm. You just feel sad. And I think there is room for, like the one thing I love it about comedy is that you can truly be yourself and not to be unapologetic, but like I wish there was I really in some of the apologies, of course, that had come out after those things, I just go, oh, I think I wish it was more. Mm-hmm. You know, more, just because I felt so sad, just because when you know that not only is it's difficult to get a job in the entertainment industry, but that if for a woman who looks up to you and then to treat somebody that way who's a colleague,
mm-hmm.
is just so depressing.
Yeah.
That's so heartbreaking. And I also, I believe those things are an illness, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't want to, like, you know, say that I heard the best, oh my gosh, joke at the Montreal Comedy Festival is a new face guy, and I cannot remember his name, but it was really a lovely joke. He said, his first one said was, I'm a registered sex offender. The only thing worse than a registered sex offender is an unregistered sex offender. At least you guys know where I'm at. I'm up here, hands up high.
Registered.
Registered. You can look it up.
Yeah.
And I appreciate, like, I can appreciate that kind of, like, name it, you know?
I also do think, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, thoughts on both sides about Louis making this, you know, comeback. He's going on tour, he's being booked at comedy clubs, but I do wonder sometimes if he was addressing what happened in a more honest or way, would that make a difference?
I think it would definitely make a difference, and I don't know. And I think also very public financial amends to those women and mm-hmm. whatever they chose to do with the financial amends. But that, but I don't know. It's so easy. It is easy to judge another human being.
Mm-hmm.
It is very easy to judge another human being. But I also, I believe, like, safety in the workplace. Like, I've been disappointed, like, hey, if somebody is an unregistered sex offender,
mm-hmm.
hey, let's make sure the workplace is safe, because nobody said they're never going to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I would say to assume somebody's going to do it again,
mm-hmm.
you know, that especially if they're not, maybe not getting help or there isn't any acknowledgement of getting help.
Yeah.
Like, just, and I know that because I feel like I'm an addict. At least, yeah, that's, I think, my own personal thing being mm-hmm. looked at. I go, ooh, unless you're getting some kind of help, I would be worried that it is going to happen again. Not like, oh, you're a bad person or you didn't mean it, that you were never going to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, let's set up a workplace environment where everybody's taken care of and safe. So that Yeah, because I think in the entertainment industry, or well, maybe in every, but there's less of a way you can complain.
Mm-hmm. So on a lighter note, I just want to end with, we ask every comedian,
yes,
who is a person that you've worked with that makes you laugh the hardest?
Oh my gosh. Miss Jackie Cation, my friend Jackie Cation, JackieCation.com, at yeah. Jackie Cation. She's the best. She's so fun. She's my friend. Thank you so much for having me on this. I know we've been cut short.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. And I'm just such a big fan of yours. And so it's just a real pleasure to get to talk to you today.
Well, much respect. Much respect.
Thanks again to Maria Bamford for sharing so much of herself on today's show. I am just such a huge fan of hers, and I really hope this interview gave you a taste of what makes her so incredible. Maria's new stand-up special, Weakness is the Brand, is available now on Apple TV, Amazon Prime Video, YouTube, and a bunch of other platforms. We'll put a link in the show notes for this episode where you can find it as well. And you can check out her talk show, What's Your Ailment, on Topic.com. If you like the show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!